Hey, good morning, everybody.
Good morning.
So here I am at Bubs, Kuala Lumpur. This is the first time I've spoken to a group here. My name is Ajahn Subaru. It's like a Subaru car, but with an O on the end, Subaru. And I have 16 vases now. So today's topic is leadership in the Sangha. And being a Westerner monk, most of us Westerners, we tend to favor and study the early Buddhist texts, especially from the Pali Canon. So I've read the early Buddhist texts now 5 times, and only after that much reading did I feel like I had a sense of what was in there and what was not in there. You know, what were the patterns? I have this talent, I think, for seeing patterns. I'm more of a technically minded person, less so a people person. Now, when it comes to leadership, if we looked to the early Buddhist texts wanting to see what's in there for leadership, you'd be surprised there's not that much which is spoken of in a direct way. The first thing I would mention is in the Mahaparinibbana Sutta, in the Digha Nikaya, it's Digha Nikaya 16, it's the sutta about when the Buddha died. And before he died, he said that when he is gone, once he's parinibbanaed, he appoints no new leader. He appoints no new leader. And instead, the leader is going to be the Dhamma and the Vinaya itself. Now, that is a rather unusual thing in that culture and at that time in history, even today as well. So usually how this sort of thing works is whoever the chief disciple is, whoever the best student is, that's who the leadership is handed down to. It's like a lineage thing. You hand down the leadership to your best student. You know, think of like a martial arts school. You know, whichever student wins the most fights at the martial arts competitions, you know, that's going to be the new leader of the martial arts school. You want your best, strongest student to carry on your lineage. But the Buddha is different here. Normally in really all, I'm no expert on Asian culture, but from what I gather, like I've done some reading, I've made some efforts to try to understand. There's been a few books I've read which have given me some insights around this. And how it normally works in Southeast Asia is you tend to have, you know, this applies to religion, this applies to like government, this applies to families, this applies to any organization. You're probably going to find some kind of strong leadership and even like authoritarian leadership, like strong leaders, confident leaders. Psychologists have tried to study, you know, why is that? What are the patterns here? How do we explain this? So psychologists would characterize... there's one pretty famous psychologist who came up with this terminology of tight culture and loose culture. Okay, so I'm from Canada. So Canada would be called a loose culture. Okay, I grew up in a very liberal part of Canada. Liberal means like the people are more laid back, more mellow, more relaxed. There's more opportunity to, more flexibility to do things your own way. There's more creativity. There's more partying. The morality is more loose. The leadership is a little more soft. Okay, so those are qualities of a so-called loose culture. And you're going to find that anywhere in the world where you tend to have more stable conditions. Stable here means like there aren't a lot of natural disasters, there aren't a lot of invaders, there aren't a lot of pandemic diseases. It's just a stable, kind of easy place to live. There aren't all these surprise disasters shaking things up. And then the parts of the world where it's more unstable, you know, there's, let's say, volcanoes, or there's, you know, there's invaders, or there's tsunamis, you know, all kinds of disasters happen. Government coups, you know, government keeps changing, etc. That is, you're almost certainly going to find a tight culture. So a tight culture is strong leaders, authoritarian leaders, rigid hierarchy, and there's a lot of rules, there's a lot of conservatism, and it's a lot less fun, unfortunately. However, when there's trouble, okay, let's say you got some invaders coming to invade your country, well, you actually do want a strong leader. If only to save your people, if only to defend yourself, you actually do want a strong leader under those conditions. You want somebody who's going to come and take charge. Okay, we're going to do this, we're going to do that. You know, you people go here and you solve this problem. Just listen to me, don't argue, you know. You actually want a strong leader in those conditions. It actually makes sense. So at the time of the Buddha, oh yeah, it was a tight culture. Very much in India. There were these different kingdoms with armies, and it's very much a world where might makes right. Might makes right, meaning like there's no rule of law. Okay, there's no human rights. There's no such thing as human rights yet. If you're strong enough to get away with something, you probably can get away with that thing. It's kind of a scary world. So yeah, the leadership style tended to be, you know, this tight, you know, strong leadership. But the Buddha is doing something different here. He's like, the Dhamma Vinaya is going to be the leader once he dies. Now we might wonder, well, you know, how do the monks kind of govern themselves? You know, you got this Dhamma Vinaya. You know, how, like, is it going to be like a democracy? How are they going to do this? You know, I'm from Canada. We have a democracy. So maybe I'd be tempted, well, of course, we should have a democracy in our Sangha. That's it. You know, I might be tempted to kind of sneak in my own views, you know, my own assumptions. But actually, no, it's not really a democracy. You know, there's many different ways that humans have kind of got government structure, you know. Is it communist? No, no, we can't really say that either. It's not. It doesn't really match. You can't really say that. Is it authoritarian? I'm going to say no. Authoritarian means there's one strong leader. Everything he says goes. He's like the king. Okay, he's like the emperor. He has total power. No, it's not like that. So then we might wonder, well, come on, is there some kind of system we can use to describe this? Some term? And I'm going to give you a guess, my best guess, what would fit. If you have a better guess, I'd like to hear it later. So, and where my guess comes from is when the British colonized India, and the British tried to understand Indian culture. You know, how do the Indians do this? How do they govern themselves? Once they observed the Indians for a while, they kind of concluded every village is a republic. Every village is a republic. Okay, and I looked up, okay, well, what is a republic? So a republic is when the citizens, the average citizen actually has pretty decent amount of power themselves, every citizen, and they elect or at least approve of some representatives. They could be, you know, elders, community elders, you know, some competent leaders. But it isn't just one leader. It's kind of like a group of leaders, and they kind of lead together, okay? They sort of share that power at the top. So that's a republic. I'm no expert in these matters, but that's the basic definition, as I understand it. Okay, it's not one strong leader. It's kind of a group of leaders. And those leaders are sort of approved of by the people underneath. And the people underneath are actually have pretty good, like, they're not like powerless. Yeah. Now, when I ask myself, you know, of the different monasteries I've lived in, I've traveled around to quite a few monasteries now. By the way, I'm one of the more rare monks who has traveled around quite a bit to different lineages in Theravada. So I was ordained in the Ajahn Chah lineage, but I've also spent time with a few other lineages too, like the Mahamevana Sri Lankan lineage, the Galdua Sri Lankan lineage. I spent time at SBS. That's almost something of its own. It's very focused on the early Buddhist texts, but it inherits from the Pauk Sayadaw lineage. Bhantarya Dhammaka was ordained in the Pauk Sayadaw lineage. So he's got a bit of a, you could say, a Mianese influence around, like, especially Vinaya. I've also spent time in a place in Malaysia here called Nandika. They're affiliated with the Pauk Sayadaw lineage as well. I've spent time in Thailand with the Ajahn Buddhadasa Thai forest lineage at a monastery called Wat Suan Mok. Wat Suan Mok. So that's another Thai forest tradition. Anyway, when I ask myself, okay, did any of those feel like a republic? I'm going to say the closest that I, you know, from my own experience, could kind of relate would be I stayed in a monastery called Na Uyana in Sri Lanka. So that's the biggest meditation monastery in Sri Lanka. You know, the monks are actually meditating. It's a big place. When I was there, well, that was like 7-8 years ago. There were about 150 monks at the time. That was the biggest monastery I ever went to. And I was really impressed when I was there. It was really well run. It was really, everything seemed to flow quite nicely, you know, the way they organized things. And I was, you know, I mentioned this to one of my fellow monks. I'm like, wow, you know, this place is so well run. I really like it. And what that monk said is, that's the sign of good governance. When you have a lot of monks who come one place, a big place, it's well run, that's how you know you have good governance. Like there has to be good leadership to get that nice smooth system like that. And to my mind, yeah, it kind of was how I would imagine a republic to work. So they had about 5 or 6 really senior monks. Okay, these are monks with like 30, 40, 50 vasas, like super senior monks. And there were several of them, okay, not just 1 or 2 or 3, there was like, you know, 5 or 6 of them. And they all commanded about the same amount of respect. All of them were given fairly equal respect. There wasn't this one senior monk who like got most of the respect, you know, let's say almost all of it. And then everybody below him, way less, you know. It was actually quite, you know, fairly equally, you know, good respect to those elders. And I loved how each of them had quite a different personality, okay, once you got to know them a bit. So one of them was really good at teaching meditation. He was sort of their head teacher of meditation. But he wasn't the most senior of all. He was maybe, you know, number 3 or 4 down the line in seniority. But they picked him to be the teacher. He had a talent for this, a talent for, you know, people skills. And so they kind of delegated that job to him. Okay, the most senior monk of all, the super senior one, he had good skills with like administration. He still had an office with a desk, and he would he would interview monks if necessary. Like I had to get permission once to stay in this solar retreat area. So he kind of interviewed me, and so yeah, he had a talent for that, and he had that job, okay? So they had sort of delegated areas according to their talents, okay? It wasn't just the one senior monk who was kind of like grand central station, you know, who's controlling everything and knows everything, and, you know what I mean? Some monasteries I've been to, whoever the senior monk is like that. They're kind of like the Grand Central Station monk. Like everything goes through that senior monk. But to my mind, this Na Uyana place, I loved how they kind of split up the roles nicely, kind of delegated them. And, you know, if one monk, let's say, moved to a different monastery, or maybe one monk got sick or something, the system could handle that pretty gracefully, you know? They'd find someone new to take that role. So the system could kind of recover fairly easily if they lost one of those senior monks. You know what I mean? It's kind of a loose arrangement where, you know, new senior monks might take a role or other ones might leave. When I was there, one of their senior monks passed away. It was Bhante Arya Dhamma, very well-known senior monk. He was just in his final days when I went there. But the monastery continued running. They had the funeral. They had it was a big event. It was on their national news. You know, it was a great big event when he died. And anyway, he was one of their best monks ever. But I could say a lot more about him, but I would stray from the topic at hand. But anyway, to my mind, that's a good system. I liked it. And I was very impressed. They all had excellent confidence in their jobs, but they were also had some humility too. They had this nice balance of humility. I was really impressed. I'm like, wow, for how senior these monks are, the humility they have, I was needing to see this example. This is amazing. I had to come to Sri Lanka to see this. This would, if I saw no other thing that made it worth it, it was to see the humility of those senior monks. I was just totally amazed. By the way, that most senior monk of all I mentioned, the administrator monk, he lived in a kuti so small, you could pretty much just reach your arms out and touch the walls, like from side to side, forward to back. It was like a concrete little box. It was like one of their smallest kutis. It's not even painted, okay? There's not even paint on the concrete. It's just gray. It was right amongst all these other kutis, same size. Even junior monks get these sorts of kutis. So yeah, that really impressed me. Really impressed me. So when I read the early Buddhist texts, I do see the Buddha doing this. He talks about how different kind of he has these foremost disciples. Okay, I'm sure you've heard of them. There's like Sariputta, Mahamoggallana, Mahakasapa, okay, etc. And each of those monks kind of has a talent that they're known for. Okay, so Venerable Sariputta, he's the foremost in samadhi or concentration. And Mahamoggallana, he's the foremost in psychic powers. And Mahakasapa, he's the foremost in like asceticism, like really tough, forest kind of dwelling, like really, really austere, really, he's this really tough character. And then different monks could sort of train under their favorite disciple, okay? If you were really good with scholarship, you're good at memorizing, well, you'd study with Venerable Ananda. Okay, so Ananda was the foremost in, he was kind of like the scholar monk. He had a talent for memorizing. Okay, so the monks are given, you might say, breathing room to practice in line with their talents. Okay, they're all following the same Vinaya. Okay, the same rules of discipline, the Vinaya. So that's kind of like the, the ground rules, maybe you might say, the Vinaya. That's the game they are all playing, which is the same game. It's the Vinaya. But once you follow Vinaya, then the flexibility opens up as to what style of practice is suitable for your personality. Now, for the first 5 years, that period of time is not very flexible when monks have to take dependence on a teacher. Okay, this dependence period, they call it the Nisaya. Nisaya means dependence. And it's a little bit like a master teaching an apprentice, okay? It's a bit like a medieval apprentice arrangement. to kind of teach new monks how to fit into monastic culture. You know, there's a lot of customs and ways of showing respect, and you know, there's kind of a lifestyle that has to be taught, which goes along with all this vinaya and, you know, all this meditating. There's kind of a monastic culture, which takes time to understand. And the Buddha does say that relationship, the teacher to student, the acharya to the student, that's like a formal role to be an acharya. It should be like a father to a son, okay? There would hopefully be sort of a father's love, you know? Father to son kind of thing. And they're supposed to spend a lot of time together, okay? Just like any good father-son relationship, they spend a lot of time together. By the way, modern psychology, when they look at what is it that makes the best parenting skill? You know, if fathers were to do only one thing right, what's the most important thing of all? And their answer is to spend time with the kids. Spending time. Those made for the best, kind of conditioning and upbringing. Yeah, spending lots of time. So the Vinaya has a bunch of customs whereby that student and the acharya do spend a lot of time. There are things they do every day. The student has duties to the teacher. The teacher has duties to the student. Okay, so that's kind of a formalized relationship for those first 5 years. So, you know, if you want to see some more formalized leadership, you could look in the Vinaya and you could learn about these duties, okay? Teacher to student, student to teacher. So they call these the Kicha Watu. Watu is duty. Duty, yeah. Wattu. So there are these kind of, there's an agreement they make. And it is kind of binding. So that is a more, you could say, stricter arrangement. But once one is released from the Nisai, then a monk has his independence, and they are free to travel around to different monasteries. So basically, as long as monks can keep their behavior kind of pure enough and keep the Vinaya well enough, they are afforded this freedom to travel around if they can manage it. You know, if they can grant it. I've done traveling around, but you know, I've been fortunate enough to get plane tickets, train tickets, car rides, etc. So you know, it's subject to the support of lay people, different organizations who've been willing to host me. Yeah. By the way, Bubs has sponsored me for a visa here in Malaysia. I'm on a visa right now. Bubs is my sponsor. So I want to say thank you to Bubs. Big thank you. I wouldn't be here without that visa. So, you know, monks, you know, they don't have as much freedom as you might like to think. Oh, they just get to run around and do whatever they want. Well, okay, you need support the whole time, though. You know what I mean? So, there is a certain amount of freedom they have, and there's a certain amount of freedom they kind of don't have, in that they need to follow Vinaya, they need to fit in well enough. Yeah, but I guess a theme I would like to kind of investigate here with you is how there is this balance. Yeah, there's structure, but there's kind of some breathing room as well. And I think the Buddha did a fantastic job of this balance, okay, of structure and kind of flexibility. By the way, that psychologist who came up with that terminology of tight culture, loose culture, her name is Michelle Gelfand. She wrote a book called Rule Makers, Rule Breakers, if you want to read it. Anyway, in her view, the best cultures have a nice mixture of tight and loose. Okay, if you can find the middle path here, the middle ground between tight and loose, that's actually the best, she says. And I agree with her. Okay, so enough structure that it's just not all, you know, too liberal and just too, you know, everything kind of falls apart. But then if it gets too tight, too strict, then it feels very oppressive. It feels very, I don't know, just stressful, you know. One kind of feels like one's in prison or something, you know. You feel like you're in jail, you know, if it's too tight. You don't have any autonomy. You don't have any agency. That feels very kind of, you know, psychologically unpleasant. But there's this nice middle ground. And I think the Buddha did a good job of finding this middle ground. And and Michelle Gelfand would further say, in really, really loose cultures, the people live on average 10 years less long. They die 10 years earlier. Okay? And in cultures that are super, super tight, they also live about 10 years less long. So if you find a nice middle, there's a bonus. You get to live 10 years longer. Okay? So there's an incentive to care, according to her. Yeah, so, all right, I want to read you a couple of brief suttas before I open it up to some question and answer. And these couple of suttas are a little more uncommon, but I feel that they convince you of this republic thing, okay? A little more. Okay, so this is the Anguttara Nikaya. Anguttara Nikaya 5.224. The title is Stingy. Mendicants, there are these five drawbacks of overstaying. What five? You become stingy with dwellings, families, material things, praise, and the teaching. These are the five drawbacks of overstaying. There are these five benefits of staying for a reasonable length of time. What five? You're not stingy with dwellings, families, material things, praise, and the teaching. These are the five benefits of staying for a reasonable length of time. Okay, so here's kind of a rare sutta where the Buddha is pointing out, from time to time, the monks actually should move from place to place. And I'm going to agree, you know, not only do we meditate, not only do we want to attain the jhanas and gain all the insight we can into anicca, dukkha, anatta, and come out of a strong sense of self, okay, come out of, let's say, any arrogance we might have, or moving from place to place once in a while, I say, is a valuable experience from being a monastic. It's valuable because it forces you to keep your possessions kind of, to keep one's possessions reduced. And it, how can I put it? There are certain characters who, if they get their chance, they kind of want to become like a dictator for life. If they, you know, that's just the kind of person they are. But if they move around from time to time, it kind of forces them to not do that. It's like, no, you can't be a dictator. Go to this other place where you're nobody again. You know what I mean? If they try to be a dictator over here, no, take them out of there and put them over here again. You see, it keeps loosening this desire they have to take over, become this like emperor type person. Okay, now here's another sutta, Anguttara Nikaya 4.25, the spiritual life. Bhikkhus, this spiritual life is not lived for the sake of deceiving people and cajoling them, nor for the benefit of gain, honor, and praise, nor for the benefit of winning in debates, nor with the thought, let the people know me thus. It's sort of like for reputation, okay? But rather, this spiritual life is lived for the sake of restraint, abandoning, dispassion, and cessation. The Blessed One taught the spiritual life not based on tradition. Let me repeat that. Not based on tradition. Culminating in Nibbana. Lived for the sake of restraint and abandoning. This is the path of the great beings, the path followed by the great seers. Those who practice it, as taught by the Buddha, acting upon the teacher's guidance, will make an end of suffering. Okay, so this sutta is worth dwelling on. Now, at the time of the Buddha, as you probably know, they had this, they called it Samana culture, where it wasn't just the Buddha and his monks and nuns in India. They had these other seekers and sages and sadhus. India's been doing this for a long, long time. So they have these kind of holy men, perhaps you've seen them before, with the ashes smeared on their body, and they have oftentimes matted hair, sometimes they're naked, okay, and they practice different paths, let's call them spiritual paths, different doctrine. And India is a very unique culture in that they are willing to support these holy men and women, and holy people, let's call them, let's be politically correct, holy people. And so the Buddha with his Sangha is just one of the groups in India, okay? And the Buddha never had to create this custom of giving alms food. That already existed before he came along. He didn't even create the custom of wearing robes. That existed before he came along. Okay, so he's just inheriting some of these structures that India already had established for his Sangha. It was easy in his day and age, easy to get alms food, easy to get support, okay, easy to get the four requisites: food, clothing, shelter, and medicine. Now, when the support is easier, one can indeed focus a lot just on one's practice, focus on just learning the teachings within one's tradition. And one doesn't have to put in a lot of effort trying to kind of persuade the lay people to offer the support, you know? Hey, wouldn't it be nice to support us monks and nuns? Wouldn't it be meritorious to support us? You know, like there's efforts to try to win that support, okay? It's a little bit like ambassadorship, being an ambassador for spirituality, or maybe even a bit of a salesman almost, you know, trying to convince and influence to win this support. And there's a certain talent in doing that, okay? Some people are kind of natural born, almost like salesman type people, okay? I'm not really one of those, but I give credit to those who have that talent. It's actually a good talent, it's people skills. Now, at the time of the Buddha, you didn't need those skills all that much, okay? Because the support was already there, okay? But when Buddhism goes spreading out of India into all these other countries, you know, let's say Sri Lanka or, you know, Malaysia, Thailand, Myanmar, etc., China, Japan, Korea, they didn't have this same samana culture thing, okay? They didn't have this same respect for the you know, the religious wanderers. There was some support. There was some support. But it wasn't as easy to get. So the reason I'm mentioning this is there's kind of a tension here, okay? There's kind of a tension between a bit of a friction, you might almost say. As Buddhism spreads to these other countries, let's not be surprised when Buddhism kind of needs monks and nuns to, they're going to need a little bit more salesman talent, you know? They're going to need a little more ambassador talent. They're going to need to make an appeal to the lay supporters to gain the support. So that does create an incentive where, you know, as we look at leadership, okay, circling back to leadership, let's not be too surprised. Let's not be too surprised when the leaders that get picked are those same types. They're the more ambassador types. They're the more salesman-minded types. They tend to be picked for leaders. But it makes sense why. Because it takes more effort to reach out to the lay people and connect and sort of win their trust, win their respect, and hopefully get support. So yeah, there are suttas, you know, like this that I read. There are several more suttas like this, a similar theme, like I just read, where it's sort of like, okay, monks, you know, stay humble. Don't get too, you know, don't get too ambitious in a quest for kind of power and control, you know what I mean? Keep it modest. Okay, well, at the time the Buddha, you could afford to be this modest, humble monk who pretty much never talked to anybody. You could just go knock on the door in the village and get alms food. You don't have to say anything. You just hold out your bowl. The food goes in the bowl. It's super easy, okay? However, as Buddhism has grown and evolved, how can I put it? Let's not be too surprised when it kind of becomes more about, you know, how many followers can we attract? How do we spread reputation? You know, how do we gain influence? It becomes a bit more of a game for followers, reputation, you know? So that's why there's friction. That's why there's tension. Okay, so this sutta is saying, you know, this is not for cajoling the lay people, gaining honor, praise, you know, etc., etc. But good salesmanship is gonna utilize those things, you know. So what can we do? You know, it's not surprising that leadership has sort of moved in that direction. Okay, I think this would happen to any religion, by the way. This is a human nature thing. I'm not blaming Buddhism here. I'm not blaming particular leaders. I'm not blaming, you know what I mean? I'm not pointing my finger at this lineage or that lineage or whatever. I'm just talking about human nature very generically here. And I'm pointing out how this this is built into the, you know, in it really, it's kind of the economic incentives, you know. The support was easy at the time of the Buddha. Today it's harder. It takes more effort, okay? In Canada, it's even harder yet. I've lived in Canada as a monk for, seven-ish years, and you know, I would be lucky to get this many people in a room in Canada. I'd be very lucky. Let's just say that. Okay, so maybe I'll just stop here and ask if there are any questions.